Welcome to Legalese, a broadcast about law cast broadly. Bienvenue à Legalese, une émission consacrée à droit qui vise à rendre le jargon plus accessible tout en évaluant de manière critique ses institutions. I'm Christophe, your host for this month's edition of Legalese. Today on the show, we'll be hearing the third episode in a three-part series about the justice system's harmful response to homelessness. These episodes were put together by some of our peers at Radlaw McGill and the Student Legal Clinic for Resilience Montreal. In this third episode, we'll hear how unhoused people are particularly at risk of being stopped and fined for offenses created by the municipal government and are disproportionately ticketed for bylaw infractions. The focus on today's episode is all about reforms and ways we can dismantle bylaws and policies that penalize homelessness and lead to discriminatory treatment and profiling of unhoused Montrealers. We will hear from Marie-Yves Sylvestre, one of the leading scholars on the judicialization of homelessness, and will speak with Balarama Homeless and Martine Museau-Mully, who are running for municipal office in November, to hear about the types of concrete actions they would push for to address this issue if elected. With that, here are the co-producers of the third episode of the series, Emily Knox and Maya Gunnarsson.
Montreal has lots of bylaws that govern the use of public spaces and prohibit a long list of behaviors like loitering, being in a park overnight, consuming alcohol on public property, or sleeping in metro stations, for example. And fines for these violations can range from anywhere between $100 to $1,000. And people experiencing homelessness who are more likely to use public spaces than others are disproportionately ticketed for these kinds of municipal bylaw infractions, with some of these bylaws effectively penalizing homelessness. And a lot of the people that we meet at the student-led Legal Clinic for Resilience Montreal share stories of being ticketed on a regular basis, and this ends up trapping them in the justice system and in the cycle of poverty.
The anti-poverty group Réseau d'aide aux personnes seules et itinérantes de Montréal describes homelessness as a process of exclusion. And this includes people who are unsheltered and live on the streets, people who live in emergency shelters, people who are provisionally accommodated and stay with friends, live in transitional housing or institutional care, and people who are at risk of homelessness and are vulnerably housed. At the student-led Legal Clinic for Resilience Montreal, we work with people from all four categories. As our next guest, scholar Marie-Yves Sylvestre has written about in her research, these groups are not rigid or static. Rather, homelessness is an experience that can be situational, cyclical, or chronic. Because people experiencing homelessness don't have access to stable housing, they tend to be forced into public spaces like parks, metro stations, and sidewalks, and this exposes them to heightened surveillance by the police, which can result in immense fines that they're unable to pay. These types of punitive responses to homelessness exacerbate the process of social exclusion.
So in a social environment where these kinds of bylaws strictly govern and control the public spaces in Montreal, some behaviors are penalized and they're over-policed in the context of homelessness. So unhoused people are subjected to state control in ways that most people in Montreal aren't. But you have to be really resourceful and resilient to live on the streets. And many of the people that we work with at the Legal Clinic situate themselves in public spaces to increase their sense of security. The problem, though, is that this kind of survival strategy ends up exposing them to elevated police surveillance, ticketing, and discriminatory treatment by the state. So because of this dependence on public spaces, unhoused Montrealers are more vulnerable to discrimination and to over-ticketing. And this issue is especially salient given the rising level of homelessness in Montreal during the pandemic.
That was co-producers Emily Knox and Maya Gunnarsson. You're listening to Legalese on CKUT 90.3 FM. They and the other students who contributed to this episode are volunteers at the student-run Legal Clinic for Resilience Montreal. Last month, we heard from Danielle Beaulieu, a Justice Support Services Coordinator at the First People's Justice Center, and two community members who use the services at Resilience Montreal. They spoke about the effects of certain bylaws and discriminatory ticketing practices in Montreal, particularly on unhoused individuals. They also spoke about some potential reforms that could be implemented to address these disproportionate impacts. Today, we will delve deeper into the reforms needed, with an expert on the judicialization of houselessness and candidates who are running in the upcoming municipal election in Montreal. First up, here are students Emily Knox and Audrey Perron in conversation with Professor Marie-Yves Sylvestre.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm Marie-Yves Sylvestre. I'm a professor and dean at the Faculty of Law at the University of Ottawa, and I've been working on criminalization of homelessness for over 15 years now, documenting the situation, particularly in Montreal, but also elsewhere in Quebec and in Canada, in different cities where homelessness is an issue. And in particular, I have worked with my colleague Céline Bello at the University of Montreal. We've documented the number of statements of offenses that were issued against homeless people who were using public spaces in Montreal and in, I think, over 10 other Canadian cities. What we've noticed across the throughout the years is that there has been a significant increase in the criminalization of homelessness, the number of tickets that are issued, but also that we were able to document and denounce the social and racial profiling that was inflicted on homeless individuals, and in particular racialized and Indigenous people who were experiencing homelessness. We've also documented the consequences of not only criminalization, but in many cases, incarceration for non-payment of fines. In 2005, if I'm not mistaken, Montreal issued a moratorium on incarceration for non-payment of fines, but that hasn't been the case in other cities in Quebec. So for instance, we have a study in Val-d'Or, in Quebec City, also in Gatineau, where we've noticed not only very important number of statement of offenses, but also that it over 75% of those cases that they end up being incarcerated, sometimes for many months and years, which you know, led to a spiral of not only rights violations, but also trauma and other very important consequences. So yes, so we've worked on criminalization through, I would say, what we call in French droit pénal réglementaire, regulatory offenses, bylaw statements, provincial statutes, but we've also looked into criminalization of homelessness through criminal law itself. And I've also conducted another study that is entitled Red Zones on the use of conditions upon marginalized people in Montreal and elsewhere in Canada that prevents them from going into certain spaces in, that they use. Whether it's for shelter, for food services, for social services, harm reduction services, and so on, as part of their bail conditions or their probation conditions. So a lot of research that has been conducted throughout the years on these issues.
OK. Puis dans le fond, dans vos travaux, là, vous référez vraiment à l'augmentation de la judiciarisation de l'itinérance. Donc, comme vous venez d'expliquer, mais est-ce que vous pourriez là, nous expliquer ce que ça signifie, cette expression-là, donc la judiciarisation de l'itinérance?
Alors, quand on parle de judiciarisation de l'itinérance, on réfère au phénomène qui consiste à confier aux tribunaux, donc au système judiciaire en particulier, la gestion des conflits sociaux liés à l'itinérance, liés en particulier à l'utilisation des espaces publics. Donc, c'est là où les conflits émergent. C'est leur présence dans les espaces publics qui est souvent non pas de danger de façon générale, mais qui est jugée dérangeante par les forces policières, par les autorités politiques, par certaines personnes dans le public aussi. Donc, la judiciarisation, c'est vraiment un déplacement, on pourrait dire, au lieu de voir la question de l'itinérance et des conflits liés à l'itinérance comme étant soit un problème social ou un problème politique ou une question de société, de coexistence, puis de partage des espaces, puis de partage des ressources. On en fait une question judiciaire. On demande aux policiers, au système judiciaire, aux acteurs judiciaires et en particulier aux acteurs du système de justice criminelle et pénale de traiter de ces personnes.
In your work, you've talked about, you know, anti-disorder bylaws and punitive responses to homelessness, like, for example, you know, regulations that prohibit sleeping in park benches or loitering. You describe these, you know, as partly based on certain stereotypes, as you were just, you know, talking about. And these are stereotypes that associate the visibility of people experiencing homelessness with signs of public disorder. And you've written in your papers that some of these bylaws are designed to make unhoused people effectively disappear from the public sphere by prohibiting behaviors that, you know, are considered normatively unruly. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit on this and talk about the history of these types of bylaws and some of the stereotypes behind them.
Well, first of all, thank you for engaging with my work, with the work of a lot of scholars. It's always interesting to have those discussions. Actually, when we think about the regulation and the criminalization of homelessness, we can think about it's a strategy of management. It doesn't come out of an idea of trying to help or assist or resolve or trying to find permanent solution to housing and rights violations that are experienced by homeless individuals. It's not a strategy to redistribute resources in society. It's really a strategy of management and making them disappear from public space so that we don't see the problem, right? And we're not confronted to those to this wealth gap in our society and to the discrimination and racism. This is a strategy of displacement, a strategy of removal, a strategy of containment. It's certainly not a strategy of conflict resolution or finding permanent solution. In the 1990s, when those first the disorder bylaws and ordinances were issued, they were based on a so-called theory broken window. Any broken window is a sign of disorder in a neighborhood on which we have to intervene so that the disorder disappears and is put aside. And, you know, in the theory, very early on, homeless people were sort of associated with a broken window themselves and a sign of disorders themselves. So really there has been this shift from material damages or dismay in the neighborhood and homeless individuals. And so that following that theory, we had to remove them. And unfortunately, this theory was very influential and has led to what so-called zero tolerance policies in many cities in Canada and the United States, but also in South America, elsewhere in Europe as well. Very influential in, you know, different forms. But basically, the idea is to make them less visible. And what I've tried to argue in one of my article is that really homeless people are, you know, losing on all fronts. And when we think about their visibility, because they're extremely visible in public spaces, which leads to profiling, which leads to discrimination, which leads to violence. And in some cases, deadly violence. But when it comes to the criminal justice system where they're pushed into, you know, when we talk with Audrey about la judiciarisation, when we move them into the criminal justice system, which is what we're doing, they become completely invisible. Their rights are not defended. They have very little assistance. Judges don't see them because they don't appear in court. They're not there to defend themselves. They fear and distrust the criminal justice system and the legal system in general. And so what we should have is more visibility in terms of rights.
I was going to say in our first episode, actually, the project coordinator at Resilience Montreal talked about this issue and, you know, the connection between gentrification, especially in the downtown core, and the displacement of unhoused people through ticketing policies over the years. And in the city of Montreal, we know that Indigenous people are grossly overrepresented amongst the unhoused population. And they also receive a disproportionate number of the tickets to people who are experiencing homelessness. And in your work, have you found or noticed any differences in the way that Indigenous people experience punitive responses to homelessness?
Completely. Unfortunately, and you know, and it's not only in my research, there's a lot of it's been documented in various commission of inquiry, and the latest being the Vien Commission. So our first study on social and the intersection of social and racial profiling and the disparate impact on Indigenous people as happened in Val-d'Or. a city where, you know, Indigenous people who experience homelessness is present in significant numbers. But and what we found is that there were issued over 75% of the tickets. And when it came to incarceration for non-payment of fines, they were almost systematically incarcerated at rates over 90%. And when we look into those who received the most tickets, those we call the over-criminalized in our study, les surjudiciarisés, 10 tickets and more, they were 100% Indigenous. Wow. So that was the first study in Val d'Or, but then the Vient Commission started inquiring at other cities, like small northern cities, including Chibougamau, Sept-Îles, La Tuque, Maniwaki, and we found that Indigenous people were also overrepresented in those cities, and in particular for incarceration. When it comes to Montreal, we have had more problems getting access to the data. But what we've noticed in our latest study, in which we documented about 50,000 tickets that were issued in the last 5 years, that there has been a significant increase, like 5 times more tickets issued in the last 5 years towards Indigenous people who experience homelessness in Montreal. So there's definitely that. And in their case, there is this intersection of the racism, the colonization and the social inequality and their being in the poverty that's playing out, and definitely that has an impact. It has an impact in terms of numbers. We can see it in the stats, but there is also an impact in terms of their relationships with the police. Mm-hmm. So one of the things, the police tend to intervene more forcefully when it comes to Indigenous people, and they're also ticketed for things that non-Indigenous people are less ticketed with. For instance, insulting police officer, disrespecting orders. So there is this tension, this authority relationship, right, that's in place, that's really entrenched and based on deeply seated relations of racism and colonization. And it's not the same situation when it comes to non-Indigenous or at least non-visibly from the police perspective, Indigenous people.
Mm-hmm. Puis, dans le fond, là, dans vos recherches, un de vos findings, un de vos résultats, c'est que souvent les comportements qui sont pénalisés, c'est pas des comportements violents. Fait que c'est quoi les infractions là, pour lesquelles les agents et les agentes du SPVM et de la STM remettent le plus de constats aux personnes en situation d'itinérance à Montréal?
Oui, alors nous, on appelle ça la criminalisation ou la pénalisation de la dérangeosité et non pas de la dangerosité. Donc, essentiellement, le plus de 80% des constats d'infraction, puis ça, c'est pas mal stable d'une ville à l'autre, avec quelques exceptions dont je pourrais vous parler, là, c'est pour l'utilisation, la consommation d'alcool ou de drogue dans les espaces publics. Donc, c'est soit une personne qui est prise en train de consommer de l'alcool ou de la drogue dans un parc, dans la rue, dans un espace public, ou une personne qui est en état d'ébriété ou de consommation, d'intoxication dans les espaces publics. Dans les deux cas, deux types d'infractions différentes. Donc, ça, c'est pour, par exemple, les règlements municipaux de la Ville de Montréal. Ce sont les deux infractions, 80-85% année après année. Sinon, on a du flânage. On a l'utilisation du mobilier urbain à des fins pour lesquelles il n'est pas destiné. Ça, c'est le libellé juridique de la disposition, mais essentiellement, c'est une personne qui se couche sur un banc de parc au lieu de s'asseoir, qui s'assoit sur un petit muret alors que le muret n'est pas fait pour s'asseoir dessus. Répandre un liquide sur le sol pour les personnes qui sont en train d'uriner. Passer sans payer dans le métro de Montréal. Avoir une cigarette allumée dans le métro de Montréal, pas tenir la main courante. Hein. Vous savez, il y a une cause qui est rendue à la Cour suprême là, pour ne pas avoir tenu la main courante. Alors ça arrive aussi aux personnes en situation d'itinérance. Donc vraiment, des comportements complètement banals, liés souvent à la survie dans la rue, si on pense à l'usage d'alcool et de drogue. Dormir dans un parc lorsque le parc est fermé. Donc, tous ces comportements là, qui ne devraient en aucun cas faire l'objet de répression, de criminalisation, qui démontrent des besoins sociaux évidents, puis indiquent clairement qu'il y a des violations de droits fondamentaux et que les droits de ces personnes-là ne sont pas respectés. Là. Ils n'ont pas accès à un logement, ils n'ont pas accès à une sécurité sociale, à une sécurité alimentaire. Ils ont peut-être été déplacés. Dans le cas des personnes autochtones, il y a encore des enjeux d'accès au territoire, de déracinement, de violence, de racisme qui expliquent cette situation-là. Donc, vraiment, elles sont pénalisées, elles sont criminalisées pour être dans les espaces, mais pour être quelque part. C'est pour ça qu'on dit que c'est de la criminalisation en partie de personnes qu'on juge dérangeantes et non pas dangereuses. Là.
Puis une fois là, qu'une personne en situation d'itinérance comme reçoit un constat d'infraction, comme qu'est-ce qui se passe après, puis c'est quoi l'impact de ça sur la vie de cette personne-là?
Alors la situation est différente selon les villes, selon les provinces, là, bien sûr, mais si on pense à Montréal, au Québec, donc une fois que la personne reçoit un constat d'infraction, la trajectoire typique là, d'une personne en situation d'itinérance qui reçoit un constat d'infraction, c'est souvent d'ignorer ce constat d'infraction, de le jeter ou de le garder, mais certainement pas de le payer, en tout cas, souvent parce qu'on n'a pas cette capacité de payer, dans d'autres cas aussi parce qu'on n'est pas nécessairement d'accord. On trouve ça complètement illégitime de devoir payer un constat d'infraction parce qu'on dort dans un parc alors qu'on n'a pas accès à d'autres ressources. Donc, il y a toutes sortes de raisons pour lesquelles les gens ne payent pas, mais en bonne partie, c'est parce qu'ils n'ont pas les moyens de le payer et ne savent pas trop comment procéder. Donc, le constat d'infraction ne disparaît pas pour autant, même si on le jette, et suit son cours à la Cour municipale de Montréal. Éventuellement, ça passe devant le greffier spécial par défaut parce que la personne n'est pas là, va pas répondre à tous ses avis de convocation. Donc, elle va être jugée. C'est-à-dire qu'elle est présumée plaidée non coupable et là, ça va suivre son cours. Donc là, elle ne comparaît pas, elle va être présumée, donc elle va être trouvée coupable et la peine minimale, c'est-à-dire l'amende, va être imposée. C'est envoyé au bureau de la perception des amendes et la perceptrice des amendes va émettre des avis, essayer de solliciter qu'est-ce qu'on peut faire. Éventuellement, le code de procédure pénale jusqu'à tout récemment permettait d'émettre un mandat d'emprisonnement pour non-paiement d'amende. À Montréal, ça fait depuis 2005 qu'il n'y a pas de mandat qui est émis et ça fait depuis 2010-2011 qu'il y a un programme, un organisme communautaire, la clinique Droit devant et d'autres organisations, mais principalement la clinique Droit devant, qui accompagne certaines personnes en situation d'itinérance à la cour municipale avec la collaboration de la cour, le programme PAGIC. Et il y a un équivalent qui est en train de se développer avec le Centre de justice des premiers peuples en matière autochtone aussi, qui permet aux personnes en situation d'itinérance là, en échange d'un certain nombre de démarches de voir retirer leur constat d'infraction et dans certains cas d'éliminer leurs dettes judiciaires qu'ils ont cumulées pendant plusieurs années et donc de continuer. Donc ça, c'est un programme innovateur, mais qui ne touche pas tout le monde. Donc ça, c'est sur le plan judiciaire, c'est ce qui se passe, mais dans la vie des gens, je pense que vous en avez eu dans votre émission qui sont venus témoigner de l'impact que ça peut avoir dans leur vie. Dans certaines villes, lorsque les gens sont incarcérés plusieurs mois, plusieurs années, l'incarcération, c'est une mesure radicale. C'est une rupture sociale, physique. Tu es arraché à ton milieu. Évidemment, si tu étais logé, tu perds tous tes arrangements en matière de logement. Si tu avais des enfants, tu vas perdre la garde. Si tu avais des démarches au niveau de l'école, au niveau d'un emploi, évidemment, tu perds tout le temps de l'incarcération. Et le processus judiciaire étant ce qu'il est, dans certains cas, c'est plusieurs années après avoir reçu des constats. Dans certains cas, la situation a changé. Là, tu es ramené dans le temps à une autre période de ta vie. Avec l'utilisation des opioïdes, présentement, être incarcéré, ça peut vouloir dire une surdose, ça peut vouloir dire du sevrage involontaire. Il y a énormément de conséquences extrêmement violentes. Bon, à Montréal, il n'y a pas d'incarcération, mais ce que ça veut dire, c'est une dette judiciaire à porter qui a un impact que tu dois régler là, parce que ça reste dans ton dossier. Dans certaines provinces, ça peut même dire que tu ne peux pas obtenir un logement puis appliquer à aucun programme gouvernemental tant que tu n'as pas réglé ta dette judiciaire. En Ontario, en Colombie-Britannique, c'est le cas. C'est pas d'avoir un compte d'hydro. C'est important aussi les conséquences sur le plan judiciaire. Ça se traduit dans des conséquences humaines.
As you mentioned earlier, the city of Montreal introduced a moratorium on imprisonment for unpaid fines related to municipal tickets. Do you think that this type of policy goes far enough to address the issue of the judicialization of homelessness, or is there anything else that we could do to take it one step further?
So no, it doesn't go far enough, but it's a very important first step. In many cities, you know, municipal authorities didn't want to apply such a moratorium. We've asked for many years in Quebec City, in Val-d'Or. In Val-d'Or, the Vient Commission forced them to impose a moratorium, issued a call for action in the midst of the commission. So it's a very important first step. And when it was issued, we celebrated because it makes a real difference for people when they're not incarcerated, for all the reasons that I've mentioned earlier about the impact that incarceration has on their lives. So we were very happy with the bill that was introduced last year. It changed the Penal Procedure Code of Quebec and does not allow for incarceration for imprisonment for a non-payment of fine in cases for which someone is unable to pay. So we were, you know, supportive of that bill. And so it's a very important first step, but really not enough at all. And all the things that have been put in place, whether it's at the municipal court or in other cities in their legal system in terms of trying to attenuate the impact of criminalization are also very important to be celebrated. But again, they are also not sufficient because we really need to make sure police don't issue tickets in the first place and that repression and violence is not employed against homeless individuals. So we, myself and our research team, we are in favor of the end of ticketing against homeless people, but also changes to municipal bylaws. For instance, we don't see why, you know, drinking alcohol in public should be criminalized. You know, there are many cities in the world where you can drink in public and that's not an issue. I mean, so that's a huge one, right? Over 80% of the tickets are linked to alcohol and drugs. We're in favor of harm reduction issues, you know, access to harm reduction services, social services being put in place. So we have to remove the police as being the first responder, basically, to homelessness and to social inequality. You know, we have to put in place services, whether it's at the social level, the health or housing solutions that provide for people to have their rights respected, basically. So the police shouldn't be the first responder, but what we found in our studies is oftentimes there's nothing else, right? Community resources are closed or inexistent. For instance, in Val-d'Or, there were only two people working overnight, two social workers for the whole city working overnight and not working during the weekend. And so the police was always called first and there was nowhere to go. Shelter was full. And I mean, that's not only a story in Val-d'Or, it's a story that occurs in other places. Sometimes the police are going at the hospital with the person and the hospital don't want them. You know, they're being shifted around. And so sometimes the police are the only responders and the only institution or service called to deal with homeless people. So that has to stop. Resources have to be put elsewhere. And social workers should be funded, but also just like in major investment in housing including in the downtown area. Because, you know, and other things that have happened in the last few years, if you think about the downtown of Montreal, you know, there's been a lot of construction, many institutions are there, and it's not only the private sectors, universities are also responsible for this push away, thinking about UQAM, but also McGill. So, you know, using the space downtown for various legitimate reasons, as push homeless people away. And when we think about the construction plans, we don't think, or urbanism and design, we don't think about homeless people being actors and being people who live there. And I think we have to have them in mind, because homelessness won't disappear even if we were a house, because there's a difference between having a house and not being homeless, because some people are offered through their housing first programs and the like, they're offered homes and house, but they don't live in them. So they need the services, the support, the network, the people around them. So we have to rethink our downtown areas also to accommodate and include.
Earlier, you mentioned that, you know, the number of tickets to unhoused Montrealer just keeps going up, and they continue to be, you know, disproportionately ticketed year after year. And so in Montreal, we have municipal elections coming up in the fall. And if you could propose, you know, any reform, or like one reform in particular to elected officials to encourage them to take action on this issue, what reform do you think would have the greatest impact to reduce the number of tickets being issued to unhoused Montrealers?
So many things that comes to mind. I'm trying to pick one. But I think this idea of imposing to any new construction project a percentage of social housing and social services, I think it has to be included in the plan. It's not sufficient to just acquire the space and put away everything that was there before. You know, it's a strategy we've used with colonization as well, with the results that we know. So we have to stop doing this, like thinking that we can start with a clean slate and just build a new thing. We have to work with what we have, and perhaps including a percentage of social housing and social services in any project would be one measure. Stop ticketing, stop using, you know, just stop ticketing. That would be wonderful as well. Although, you know, there's always the risk that if they cannot ticket homeless people anymore, then they're going to turn to criminal law, as they've done for sex work, for instance. They've stopped using, you know, for many years, they stopped using bylaws for sex workers, and they've turned to criminal law. So there's this, you know, criminalization is a toolbox. Police officers have a toolbox. And so sometimes it's kids and sometimes it's criminal. So you have to be cautious when you play with their toolbox, because it doesn't disappear. So the repression scheme, I think, has to change. So yeah, stop ticketing, social housing, social services, harm reduction. There are many things that have been put in place, like wet shelters as well is a big one. Thinking about drug use also as something that will stay and not something that will disappear. And yeah, find solutions for all sorts of people and all sorts of situations. Culturally adapted as well for, and not, you know, I don't want to say culturally adapted, but specific for Indigenous people, that is acknowledging their realities and their past, present and future.
Yeah, so thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. So thank much. You for having me. Merci beaucoup.
You're listening to Legalese on CKUT 90.3 FM. That was Marie-Yves Sylvestre, Dean of the Faculty of Law at the University of Ottawa and a leading scholar on the judicialization of homelessness in Quebec. Next up is McGill Law student Camila Franco speaking with Balarama Holness, the mayoral candidate and founder of Mouvement Montréal. You will hear Holness talk about a compassion-based approach to homelessness in the city and his vision to repeal certain bylaws that penalize homelessness.
All right, so first of all, of course, thank you so much for being with us today. We are so thrilled to have you. Maybe you can introduce yourself and tell the listeners a little bit about yourself to start off.
Hi, everyone. My name is Balarama Holness. I am the founder of a nonprofit organization called Montreal in Action. We take action on things related to democracy, citizenship, systemic racism, and equality. I am also a father to a beautiful baby girl, Bella. I am a McGill graduate, and back in the day, I was with the Montreal Alouettes, where I won a Grey Cup championship in 2010. So that's about it.
Perfect. Really from the community. In this part series, we've been discussing some of the bylaws that govern the use of public spaces, which prohibit, for example, loitering, being in a park overnight, consuming alcohol in public property, and sleeping in metro stations. We know that nearly 40% of all the tickets issued go to unhoused Montrealers. And so in effect, these bylaws are penalizing people in our community who are unhoused and kind of being fined for the same actions that other people are engaging in the privacy of their own homes. We are wondering, of course, there's an upcoming municipal election, and as the leader of Mouvement Montréal, we want to know, what is your stance on this issue? How do you view this issue? What do you think could be done? Yeah, what's your opinion on the matter?
Well, firstly, one of the reasons why I decided to run for mayor of Montreal was in 2017, I ran for mayor of Montreal North, which is a very underprivileged borough in the northeast of the island, where there are issues of homelessness, of housing, of affordability, of unemployment, of mental health, issues of racial profiling. And what I found is that the state, just generally, whether it's municipal, provincial, or federal government, does not pay attention to those that do not elect them. And unfortunately, people who are houseless, well, they do not hold a lot of clout when it comes to politics. They are not influencing the legislator as much as, say, a homeowner. And that is why we see, for example, right here in Montreal, 24,000 people on the waiting list for social housing. And many of those people are marginalized. They are, whether they're single parent mothers, whether they're people with exceptionalities, with mental health issues, with issues of drug abuse or alcohol abuse. It's people who have fallen through the cracks. And ultimately, we need a government that is not just vote seeking and office seeking, but a government that is going to attune to the needs of all of Montrealers. When I'm speaking right here, as I'm running for mayor of Montreal, and ensure that those who are the most forgotten are paid attention to. So as mayor of Montreal, one of the things we want to do to address the issue of housing is to create affordable for rent properties. It's been about 30 years where we have not been building for rental properties, but mainly condominiums, as you've seen, which are highly unaffordable. And so that's one aspect. And the other aspect, specifically on homelessness, and you mentioned it briefly, regarding the incivilities and tickets. Mm-hmm. And we need to find a way to have individuals with health and social service expertise intervene and help people who are homeless. And right now what's happening is they're being commercialized by the state through the form of tickets. And ultimately that needs to end, and we need to have a more compassion-based approach with how we deal with homelessness and people who are living in the streets.
Thank you. So, you actually touched on something perfect. I know that the statement for Mouvement Montréal is people before politics. Yeah. And I would love for you to kind of explain what that means a little bit more, because you said it yourself, usually it's not very popular political strategy to kind of tailor a campaign to folks who are the most vulnerable. And so, that statement really speaks to me. And I'm wondering how do these things align, and what do you think, as someone right now, engaging in kind of a political campaign, view that reality that, yeah, maybe these folks are kind of a little bit, tend to be, because of the precarious situations they're living in and the multiple kind of vulnerabilities that they have, might not be as politically engaged. How do we engage these folks? And, why have you taken the stance? What does people before politics mean to you?
Yeah, it's very interesting. So the day that I was going to announce that I was running for mayor of Montreal, I was not nervous at all. And I was wondering, shouldn't I have butterflies? Shouldn't I be excited? And even the day before my announcement, I wasn't excited. I had no butterflies. Went down to City Hall and I'm like, okay, maybe I need to get a coffee, because I am feeling like this is just any other day. I'm going to speak to Cam on this podcast. I just felt like it was just any other day. And then right when I announced and I said, you know, hi everyone, you know, my name is Balaram Maholness. I'm here, I'm running for Mayor of Montreal, new political party. Mm-hmm. It was just so natural. And the first thing I said is, we are not politicians. We are not politicians. We are gonna put people before politics, and we are going to address the real needs of Montrealers, even if they are unpopular. And that's really what we mean by people before politics, is addressing your real needs. And I'll give you one clear, easy example. Mm-hmm. Right now, there are a lot of shootings in the city of Montreal. We've seen a rise in violence, and it is unpopular to say reallocate funding from police to social services, to sports, leisure. That's not popular. But the reality is, that's how you fight crime. We have a vision almost like, you know, this Bruce Willis, Tom Cruise vision of descending in SWAT teams in low-income neighborhoods to solve crime. Mm-hmm. But the real way to do it is to invest in young people. And that's another example of people before politics, is we are going to put the people first and not bow to political sentiment or what's popular at the time. We're going to just say what's right, regardless of whether we lose votes on that issue or not.
What is the extent of what a municipal government can do to support and give more funding to, for example, considering that a lot of the folks who aren't housed and are being kind of criminalized by these bylaws carry traumas and are suffering with a lot of substance misuse illnesses at the municipal level? Is there things that can be done to address that?
Well, 100%. And you put the hammer on the nail. First of all, these are bylaws. These are not laws that are passed at the National Assembly at the provincial level. So we could decriminalize, if you will, incivilities by removing these tickets for loitering, removing these tickets for small little things that we basically, there are loopholes to allow police officers to intervene and to criminalize and to really put pressure on people who are marginalized. So this is something very, very concrete that municipalities can do all across Canada. And that's something that I intend to do as Mayor of Montreal, is to ensure that the bylaws that are basically a gateway in order to intercept people of color or Indigenous persons. And we all know, and I'll slow down my speech here because this is a very important stat, Indigenous women are 11 times more likely to be stopped by the SPVM. That is an egregious number. And why are they stopped? Well, as you mentioned it, these small incivilities that are used to excessively ticket them and simply make their lives miserable, that does not solve their issue. And also, you could fund specific organizations. I want to give one in particular called The Open Door. John Tessier, he's actually a candidate with Movement Montreal, works with people at Milton and Park, who many of you may know, that has a population of Inuit and Indigenous persons who are homeless and who are suffering tremendously. So by funding spaces like The Open Door, the Native Women's Shelter with Nakuset and others, you are supporting communities that are on the front lines of the houseless crisis.
You know, I was going to kind of bring up that a lot of the language that some of these bylaws use are actually pretty vague. And so police kind of have the power of discretion and to kind of decide as to what represents quote unquote public nuisance or, you know, using urban furniture for another means, AKA usually sleeping on a public bench, etc. And so you from what I understand is that you kind of believe that it's better to kind of repeal these bylaws as opposed to tweak language so that it is more precise to leave SPVM with less kind of
room. Because if you tweak it, you mentioned it, it's always going to be open to their discretion. There is no need to have any bylaw that adjudicates or establishes how you are to use a park bench. And you know, that's one big issue. And I'll give you a great example. I am mentoring a group of youth, and they were all on Bixies. Mm-hmm. And as they arrived to the Old Port, they're all there with tickets. And I asked them why they have tickets. And they said it's because they were biking side by side in the street. And this is an example. And these are young youth of color. And it's very easy for the police officer to say, yes, this should be a rule. So you should not be biking four people in the street because it is a hazard. But a police officer can, with facilitation, provide a warning. Yeah. If it was, for example, four frat boys from Boston, you know, dressed, you know, going to a wedding and dressed in tuxes, would they mm-hmm. have received the same treatment? Impossible to know. But the data does show that mm-hmm. people of color are over-ticketed. So while we do still need some bylaws to preserve safety. I think that we need more judicious and compassionate police officers.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for your time. Honestly, it was a pleasure hearing from you.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much for the invite.
Of course.
That was Camila Franco, a McGill law student, speaking with Balarama Holness, who is running for mayor with Mouvement Montréal in the upcoming municipal election. You're listening to Legalese on CKUT 90.3 FM. Projet Montréal's platform in the 2017 municipal elections acknowledged and engaged with social profiling. Projet Montréal pledged to prevent the judicialization of homelessness and related physical interventions through police training and reporting requirements. Despite this commitment, the ticketing of unhoused Montrealers reached a peak in 2019, with more than 8,000 tickets being issued to people experiencing houselessness. Our first guest, Marie-Yves Sylvestre, mentioned this statistic is 8 times higher than the number of tickets issued when she first began compiling the data in the mid-90s. Legalese's Audrey Perron sat down with Projet Montréal's candidate for Villerie, Martine Museau-Mouilly, to talk about this issue.
Mon nom est Martine Moussaou-Mouilly. Je suis avocate de formation. Je dirige mon propre cabinet boutique qui s'appelle Mouilly. Et je me présente également à titre de conseillère de ville dans le district de Villerie, arrondissement de Villerie, parc extension Saint-Michel, pour l'équipe de Projet Montréal aux élections, jour du scrutin à noter du 7 novembre 2021.
Vous êtes invité au dernier épisode d'une série sur la judiciarisation de l'itinérance. Fait que par là, ce qu'on veut dire, en fait, c'est vraiment des infractions municipales, des infractions qui sont prévues au Code des arrondissements, aussi par la Société des transports de Montréal, puis qui ciblent ce qu'on appelle comme les incivilités. Fait que, par exemple, ne pas obtempérer aux ordres d'un policier ou d'un policière, être visiblement là, intoxiqué dans un lieu public, dormir sur un banc. Ce qu'on constate, c'est que ça pénalise effectivement l'itinérance, ça crée des dettes judiciaires, ça crée aussi des déplacements de personnes itinérantes qui sont en fait chassées, là, des lieux qui sont historiquement occupés. Et puis ça crée là, évidemment aussi beaucoup de tensions donc entre les personnes en situation d'itinérance et les voisinages dans lesquels ils sont, mais aussi entre les personnes en situation d'itinérance et la police. Donc, Projet Montréal a beaucoup jasé puis fait à propos des logements sociaux puis a octroyé là, pas mal aussi de fonds, donc particulièrement l'année dernière et cette année aux organismes communautaires qui supportent les personnes en situation d'itinérance. Cela dit, est-ce que ça serait quelque chose que Projet Montréal envisagerait de réviser de fond en comble les règlements municipaux qui ciblent les incivilités puis qui pénalisent l'itinérance ou les comportements associés à l'itinérance puis voir là, d'en abolir certains de ces règlements-là, par exemple, justement l'interdiction de consommer dans des lieux publics qui n'est pas une infraction dans plusieurs villes du monde?
C'est une préoccupation qui est très valable. Puis, je trouve ça intéressant que vous souleviez la question parce que ça reprend l'une des recommandations qui avait été formulée suite à la commission qui s'est tenue en 2017 sur la question du profilage racial et social. Donc, on comprend que quand on parle de profilage social notamment, les personnes qui vivent avec le défi de l'itinérance sont souvent ciblées. Vous l'avez très bien expliqué, il y a certains enjeux où on doit se poser la question. À titre de collectivité, pour se dire, premièrement, on sait très bien que tant au niveau municipal, provincial et fédéral, qu'il y a une surreprésentation de certaines communautés qui sont, voire facilement, judiciarisées, et vous avez identifié par exemple les communautés autochtones du Québec et du Canada. Ce qui veut dire que suite à cette commission, il y a une réflexion qui a été entamée. Cette question justement de revoir la réglementation municipale pour s'assurer de ne pas contribuer davantage à l'enjeu est étudiée depuis déjà 2 ans, je vous dirais. Il y a un groupe qui s'est rassemblé pour identifier jusqu'à maintenant, de ce que j'ai reçu comme information, au moins 13 règlements municipaux où plusieurs intervenants qui viennent avec différentes expertises ont pour mission de s'assurer non seulement d'identifier quel type d'infraction devrait faire l'objet d'une analyse plus poussée, identifier les modifications, voire les abrogations qui doivent se faire, pour s'assurer, bien entendu, qu'on ne va pas commencer à émettre des constats quand il n'y a pas lieu. Et là où il faudra conserver les infractions, bien, c'est de se dire quelles sont les alternatives. Quelles sont les pistes de solutions qui vont nous permettre de s'assurer qu'on est en mesure de conserver une ville où tout le monde trouve sa place, le sentiment de sécurité est préservé pour l'ensemble des Montréalais qu'on ne cherche pas nécessairement à user de la force policière à tout coup, pour tout enjeu, et qu'on s'assure d'intégrer justement les ressources communautaires pour gérer les enjeux où l'implication sociale est davantage pertinente à l'intervention policière. Alors, quand vous me parlez de judiciarisation, absolument. Projet Montréal adresse le sujet depuis plusieurs années déjà.
Bon, en ayant en tête là, les événements de la dernière année, donc qui ont été très, très, très médiatisés, je pense au démantèlement du campement Notre-Dame dans Hochelaga-Maisonneuve, au débat aussi autour du Square Chabot, puis au clôturage d'espaces longuement occupés par des personnes itinérantes inuites à Milton Park. Ben, pourquoi est-ce que Projet Montréal ne serait pas comme davantage impliqué dans l'aménagement d'un espace public plus accueillant pour les personnes qui n'ont pas de logement, puis comment est-ce que ça peut changer à l'avenir?
Quelle bonne question! Ça, je pense que c'est peut-être la question d'aujourd'hui. OK? Je pense que, premièrement, il faut rétablir les faits. Quiconque voudrait dire que Projet Montréal ou bien l'administration municipale n'a pas fait assez, je les inviterais à vraiment valider leurs faits. Projet Montréal s'est fixé cette année, ou devrais-je dire l'administration municipale, des objectifs pour assurer notamment 950 logements sociaux qui visent les personnes qui vivent avec les défis de l'itinérance. Cet objectif de 950 logements a été dépassé. Imaginez-vous qu'en date d'aujourd'hui, on compte 1089 nouveaux logements sociaux qui visent précisément cette communauté. Non seulement ça, mais si on parle des fonds qui ont été investis pour s'assurer de contribuer à répondre à cette problématique, je vous lance des chiffres comme ça, mais vous irez valider. On parle de 2,3 millions de dollars qui ont été donnés à près d'une quarantaine d'organismes au cours des 12 derniers mois pour les aider, eux, dans leurs propres initiatives qui visent à aider justement cette communauté qui vit avec les enjeux d'itinérance. Donc, logements sociaux objectifs dépassés, non seulement la question de l'itinérance n'est pas strictement dans la juridiction de Montréal, mais il y a eu un ajout, il y a eu un support justement auprès du système du réseau de santé. Comptez également le support dont je vous ai fait mention auprès des organismes communautaires. Et lorsqu'on parle de campement, qui a été, oui, un enjeu majeur, imaginez-vous donc que vous avez une administration municipale qui a eu le courage de déclarer un état d'urgence pour se permettre justement d'approcher des hôtels pour s'assurer que des lits seraient disponibles pour les personnes qui sont dans le besoin. L'équipe qui est en ce moment en train de diriger la ville de Montréal est allée au-delà de sa propre juridiction. Je fais un rappel à tous. La question de l'itinérance est une question qui est traitée normalement par le ministère de la Santé, donc on parle du provincial, qui, elle, alloue des fonds au CIUS du centre de Montréal. Donc, le CIUS qui, lui, opère l'ensemble des opérations pour justement tout le réseau de la santé et le réseau social qui gère les enjeux. Sur cette base, vous avez l'administration municipale qui, elle, vient soutenir, collaborer et surtout qui est en mesure d'envoyer les bonnes personnes pour identifier les enjeux et maintenant les rapporter aux personnes responsables. Pour dire, écoutez, vous avez reçu des fonds du provincial, voici nous les enjeux que nous avons identifiés. Plus précisément, l'administration municipale actuelle s'est assurée de mettre en place un plan d'action. 2018-2020, je vous invite à aller voir sur le site Internet un travail de tonnerre. Vous avez le détail des quatre piliers, notamment, qui fondent la base de ces interventions. Et bien entendu, on a le plaisir, voire le privilège d'avoir un commissaire qui est attitré à cette question également. Donc, le travail est entamé depuis déjà un bon moment.
Oui, ben, je suis vraiment, j'entends ce que vous dites. Tu sais, pour revenir, mettons, à la situation là, du démantèlement du campement de Notre-Dame, moi, ce que je me demande, c'est, puis j'imagine ce que plusieurs personnes se demandent aussi, c'est qui prend cette décision-là?
À titre général, il faut comprendre que toute décision dans une administration municipale se prend en concertation et en collaboration. Une administration municipale saine, on se comprend bien. Donc, quand vous me demandez qui prend la décision, ça a nécessité l'intervention, l'expertise et bien entendu les perspectives de toutes les personnes concernées. Ça veut dire que les riverains, les voisins doivent être entendus. Vous le savez, les plaintes, il y a des plaintes qui sont formulées, elles sont valables parce qu'on peut comprendre très bien que le vivre ensemble, la mixité sociale, représente encore un défi. Le démantèlement s'est notamment fait parce qu'il y a eu un grand enjeu de sécurité qui a été identifié, celui d'un risque d'incendie. On ne pouvait pas se le permettre. Les démantèlements, ce ne sont pas nécessairement la première approche, parce qu'un démantèlement, on comprend que c'est une approche qui est solide, une intervention policière, une intervention des fois du service d'incendie de Montréal. Alors, on veut éviter de traumatiser là où il n'y a pas à faire, surtout lorsqu'il existe des alternatives. Alors, des fois, des décisions difficiles doivent se prendre, un pied ferme doit être mis par terre pour s'assurer justement que on agit selon ce que les situations requièrent.
Ce matin, Will Prosper a été annoncé comme étant un nouveau candidat de Projet Montréal à la mairie de Montréal-Nord. Donc, Will Prosper, c'est un militant antiraciste qui s'est prononcé en faveur du définancement de la police. Je pense que cet enjeu-là du définancement est aussi lié à la surjudicialisation de l'itinérance. Est-ce que vous avez une opinion sur le définancement de la police? Est-ce que c'est quelque chose que vous...
J'ai pas d'opinion à partager aujourd'hui, je vais vous dire pourquoi. Parce que je suis une juriste, je suis quelqu'un qui travaille avec les faits et je ne me prononce pas simplement sur la base du vent ou de la tendance d'aujourd'hui. Alors, si j'avais quelque chose à dire sur le sujet, il faudrait que ça soit intelligent. Je n'ai pas de faits à vous partager aujourd'hui sur le sujet. Par contre, je tiens à rappeler à tout le monde que Projet Montréal, l'équipe actuelle de Valérie Plante, il n'est pas question de définancer. Au contraire, certains d'entre vous l'avez vu dernièrement, l'ancienne administration avait fait une coupure de 34 millions de dollars qui a été heureusement corrigée par l'administration actuelle pour répondre aux besoins qui sont réels sur l'île de Montréal, dont les enjeux de sécurité qu'on a constatés de toute évidence avec les 4 fusillades qu'on a eues au mois d'août et on vient de commencer le mois. Donc, pour ce qui est des faits tels qu'ils existent aujourd'hui, je ne vois pas pourquoi on associe la question de définancement à l'administration actuelle.
Faites le mot de la fin, à vous.
Restons optimistes. Vous l'avez vu, le slogan de Projet Montréal cette année est relatif au fait qu'il s'agit de la bonne équipe. J'en suis persuadée. Mon mot de la fin, merci beaucoup.
This was the last episode in our three-part series about discriminatory bylaws and the justice system's response to homelessness. For today's episode, we reached out to other municipal parties to invite them to share their perspectives on this issue. However, they declined. Thank you to everyone who participated and contributed their knowledge and experiences over the past 3 episodes.
If this is an issue that interests you, you can lend your voice to those who are advocating for change. So there's an upcoming municipal election in Montreal that's happening on November 7th, and citizens can choose their city and their borough representatives. If you want more information about how to register to vote and the candidates that will be running in your riding, you can go to elections.montreal.ca.
Remember, the people we elect in November will represent us for the next 4 years, so please make your voices heard.
In between elections, you can still advocate for change. You can sign petitions, write to your elected officials, pen opinion pieces in local newspapers, and if you can, donate to organizations that work with unhoused Montrealers and that do anti-poverty work. Some of the organizations featured on this show included Resilience Montreal, the Native Friendship Center of Montreal, and the First Peoples Justice Center. These are all great organizations that are doing amazing work in the city, but there are also plenty of others, so you can find out what organizations are operating in your neighborhood and lend support in any way that you can.
However you choose to do so, staying engaged in this issue is the only way we will be able to change the way our city responds to homelessness. Here at Legalese, we envision a city that responds with compassion rather than punishment to community members who find themselves unhoused.
Vous écoutez une émission de Legalese sur CKUT 90.3. That's all from us today. Thank you for listening, and thanks to everyone who contributed to the show. You can listen to Legalese every second Friday of the month from 11 a.m. till 12 noon on CKUT 90.3. If you have ideas of topics you'd like us to cover, legal or not, you can write to us at legalese@ckut.ca. If you like what you heard today, you can find extended versions of today's show, as well as episodes from our backlog.
Good afternoon. You're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked into CKT 90.3 FM.
She said she's only texting you.